From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Oscar Solis thought he would retire in California, that he would serve out his ministry as a priest there in Los Angeles. A native Filipino, Solis served in the largest Catholic diocese in the country, 5 million people. He had worked with Italian and Cuban Catholics in New Jersey, French and Creole Catholics in Louisiana. His call to be the bishop of the Salt Lake City diocese came in January, and he says it took him off guard. But here he is. And today in the program, Bishop Solis is joining us to talk about his faith journey and his plans for leading Utah's Catholics. Solis is asking them to do what Pope Francis is asking of all Catholics, to get out of their comfort zone. But how do you do it here? Join us after the news.
Support for this Radio West podcast comes from Salt Lake County Animal Services, a no-kill municipal shelter specializing in pet adoptions, licensing, humane education, and more. Located at 511 West, 3900 South in Salt Lake City. More information is at AdoptUtahPets.com.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Oscar Solis is the first Filipino-American bishop in the Catholic Church. Earlier this year, he was installed in the Diocese of Salt Lake City. Solis has had plenty of opportunities to tell the story of when he got the phone call about his new assignment. It came last January from a representative of Pope Francis. Solis was what they call an auxiliary bishop in the Los Angeles diocese at the time, and he was pretty well settled in. By that point, he had served in various places around the country, New Jersey, Louisiana, and he figured California would be his last place. He's described the call as a curveball out of nowhere, even asked the papal representative if he was in trouble. Solis leads some 300,000 Utah Catholics now, and in April he gave them his first indication of what he was going to expect of them. He wrote an official pastoral letter telling them to learn and live their religion and get out of their comfort zone. We had a chance to talk to the bishop yesterday. He joined us in the studio for a conversation, and we began with the first time he knew he would live his life as a priest.
Well, actually, my vocation to the priesthood, the becoming a priest, was instilled in my mind by my mother. I grew up closely with priests when I was a young kid. I was an altar server, and there are a lot of older seminarians, those who are studying for the priesthood in our hometown, who took us in, you know, and make us feel at home and have a feeling of what priestly life and ministry is all about. And I had the tremendous support of my family as well as friends and other people. Great role model, so somehow it was molded slowly. And I entered the seminary at the tender age of 11 as a first year high school. And then somehow you were railroaded because you were there, you know.
Yeah.
And then eventually, as you mature, you develop a different thinking and look of what priestly life is all about. I would say that I have a firm decision that has been made by me sometime in my college days.
That's what
after
really
I finished
fixed
college,
it?
Yes. There was something missing because all my life from 11 years old until I graduated in college, that was the turning point when I left the seminary, you know, and taught in the high school seminary where I studied in high school, and then felt something missing. And then I took a year off and took some law. My dad wanted me to become a lawyer. And so, but there was something there. Something is missing in there. So I decided to go back, and that was the turning point. When I went back to the seminary to pursue my theology studies, like what you called proper, you know, then that's where I solidified my desire to become a priest.
I'm not sure how much to make of this, but there was a time when you would consider, I know you considered doing a lot of things you've talked about for a career. Architecture, was that an interest for you?
No, actually what interests me when I was young and ambitious was to be a doctor.
Yeah.
I wanted to be a doctor. I wanted to be rich.
Right.
Like any other people.
Yeah.
You know, but God has other plans somehow, you know, and I am convinced that I made the right choices in my life because I found inner joy and peace in what I'm doing and how I live.
You have talked about growing up, again, that kind of transition period when the Vatican II comes about.
Mm-hmm.
What was that like, being a Catholic at that time, as this transition is going about within the Church?
I was young to really understand all those, the ramifications of the transitions. But I find I was happy. I was happy living it, you know, and doing the things, not conscious of really the transition. Because I was 11 years old when I entered the seminary in 1965, and that was the time of the Vatican Council, you know, after the Vatican Council, the Second Vatican Council. So really, at that age of 11, I really don't understand everything. But I enjoyed the celebration of the Mass, the kind of worship during that time, you know, the participation of the people instead of just looking and staring at the priest. So those are some little things that I noticed, you know, that made an impression in me. That worshiping, being a faith community, is fun. Yeah. It's fun, you know.
Pope Francis has said that he had empty moments of doubt about God's existence throughout his life in some ways. He said, in fact, he said there were many times that he had a crisis of faith. And then he said, a Christian who, and I'll quote him here, who hasn't doubts, who hasn't had a crisis of faith, is a Christian who's probably missing something. You had those moments, those empty moments?
Well, Pope John Paul is a saint. He's a holy man. How much more about me? If he has 100 moments of doubt, I have thousands of moments of doubt in my life. I think it's a component, it's part and parcel of growing. A lot of times that you think so many things and you try to understand, you know, but it's only God. It's a matter of submission and obedience. It is the submission of your own being to God's will that where you could find answer to those beautiful and meaningful moments in your life. You know?
I've read certain stories that I'm sure challenged you. May not have challenged your faith, but I know you had a brother who drowned.
Mm-hmm.
You had another brother who was stabbed to death.
Yes.
And I'm wondering, how did your faith work in terms of comprehending those and what that meant?
I have the natural disposition, like anybody else during that time, to question why, as well as my emotions, deep emotions of hatred and pain and anger. But my mom was a beautiful mother who instilled in our minds some sort of peace and understanding. They hid everything that had transpired legally, you know, but they wanted us to move on. And understanding that these are what part of our life. There will be tragedies, there will be pain, there will be suffering, there will be illness, you know. And so there was some sort of maturity that came out of it. And it made us who we are, much stronger, to be able to face some challenges and difficulties in our life. So I found it wonderful teaching moments and opportunities for growth, to strengthen my character in order to be able to face whatever challenges or tribulations that I might face in my life. Yeah.
You come in 84. You took a study break. And as I've read anyway, you wanted to study, this was interesting, Buddhism and Hinduism and Shintoism. What was it about these other philosophies that interested you?
When I was in theology, after finishing my degree in theology, my bachelor's degree in theology, they were looking for some specialization on higher religious education, you know. And for what reason, I was inclined to take something different. And there was an institute that was established in the university called the Oriental Religions, Institute of Oriental Religions, something quite different, really. So part of it is just to be playful. Instead of going to the seminary to study, we are in the graduate school outside the seminary premises. And so that was the personal part. And it's quite interesting to know the different kinds of religions and philosophies. It was a blessing in disguise, actually, to be able to indulge in this study of such religions and philosophies, because I never thought that I'm going to the United States to be confronting diverse cultures in my ministry as a priest and eventually as a bishop.
I wonder, when you came to the United States, did you see yourself as an outsider? Oh, well, clearly you were an outsider, and I wonder what that was like first coming.
Looking back, I was blessed. Huh. I was blessed by the spirit of America. That is welcome. I was blessed to be assigned in a parish in New Jersey when I came in 1984. And an Italian priest welcomed me to the parish and embraced me as one of their own. The Italian community and the Spanish community, Puerto Ricans and majority are Cubans, right, were wonderful. Were wonderful. I could really say and admit that I experienced the spirit of America to welcome strangers and be given the opportunity in order to grow and to contribute to our society.
I wonder what that perspective, coming here to a new place, encountering, as you say, the blessing of America, the spirit of America, what kind of perspective did that give you with dealing those in your parish who are immigrants, legal or otherwise? Mm-hmm. What kind of message did that offer that you could provide to them, your own personal experience? Right.
I wish America would be the same as when I came here in 1984. Friendly, welcoming, hospitable to those who come to the shores of America to find a better life, to be given the opportunity to grow and to develop and to become contributing citizen to this country. That's what I see America is all about. That's what America made. That's what makes this nation a great nation, a great country. And that's the reason I think we are blessed. And I hope we can maintain that welcoming attitude and disposition to those who want to have a better life and to find opportunities for them to grow.
But we don't have it that way now. It's not like 1984. I'm sure you...
I'm a person of hope. I'm a person of hope. I'm hopeful that the hearts of people will see the lives of other people in their own way. That what they want for themselves, it could be provided for others. And so what they wish for themselves, I wish they can wish for those others who came. I think America and people now living in the States have short memories. Anyone who came to the United States were immigrants other than the Native Americans. And they have one thing in common, better life, better opportunities. And they were given that. And I hope America stands for that wonderful principle of giving everyone who comes to the shore the opportunity to have a better life.
In 2004, you went to Los Angeles to as an auxiliary bishop there, mm-hmm, oversaw the archdiocese ethnic ministries, among other things. Mm-hmm. It's the country's largest diocese. Mm-hmm. Three-quarters are Hispanic. Mm-hmm. And it's believed that close to a million in that diocese are undocumented immigrants. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, when you were called to come to Utah, it's very different in many ways, and I wonder what you made, your initial reaction to the change now. I mean, it's a place that is very white. Clearly, lots of immigrants, of course, here. I'm not mm-hmm. saying that's not true, but it seems like the makeup of this place is decidedly different from what you had encountered in California, in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. So how were you thinking about what you are coming to see here in Utah?
I am spoiled and great, but grateful. I'm spoiled by God's blessing, but grateful for every good things that I receive from God and other people. I couldn't remember any instance where I am treated differently. When I came to Utah, people were so welcoming, so hospitable, so accommodating, you know, and I felt the joy of being here, realizing that immediately I felt I am home. This is my home, you know, and this is my place. And
Wasn't there ever, though, a moment when you thought, it's a, relatively speaking, it's a very small diocese here. It doesn't have the same kinds of challenges. I don't know. I wonder if you worried about that it wasn't going to be the same kind of challenge as it must have been in Los Angeles.
Geographically, I'm ignorant. I don't know where even Utah is what Utah was, you know.
Yeah.
But I think what made the difference is my disposition in my life as a priest. I believe that aging is a factor.
It is. Yeah.
As you grow old, somehow you get a different perspective in life. Ever since I became a bishop, I have given my life totally to God and to the church. I am at total disposition of God's will and the church. And so wherever they want me, I go there wholeheartedly. The only thing that I worried coming to Utah is that, Utah, where is Utah? And when I heard snow, dear Lord, dear Lord, snow. And so that was the only reaction I have actually when I heard that I'm going to Utah. And actually, jokingly, I said, what did I do wrong? What did I do wrong? Why have to go to Utah? But after that press conference, I said that God knows better.
Yeah.
This is my place. He wanted me to be here. And so here I am. Here I am.
What do you think it's like as a Catholic to live in a place so dominated by another faith, a faith, of course, mm-hmm. that's not your own, the LDS Church? Is it your first encounter with something like that?
Well, actually, it's not the first encounter. I can remember right during the press conference, I mentioned that my first encounter of an LDS is one of those missionaries, you know, who go knocking door to door, and that was my first encounter and experience of an LDS, their missionaries, and I admired them. I admired them for their conviction, you know, and for their missionary zeal to share their faith with others, you know, and that's how I got my impression about them. It's their conviction and their love for their faith and to share their belief to others.
What's it like being Catholic here in a state that has so many Latter-day Saints? I mean, does mm-hmm. that make you think differently of your relationships with the LDS Church? I mean, how do you describe that relationship, I suppose, if there is one in that way?
Our Catholic Church stands strongly in the spirit of ecumenism, respecting different faiths, denominations, and ideologies. We believe that we do not have the monopoly of truth, you know, and there's always something good in everything. And that's why we have admiration and respect, even though we differ in traditions, in other ways and practices. And yet we respect each one. We respect each one, you know, and we work with them. We work with them. And that's why we're open to dialogue. We're open to interfaith, religious activities and events, you know, and we work hand in hand with them. Communicating with them, extending whatever support we can give in order to develop more solidarity and unity among each other, knowing after all that we have one vision and one goal, to serve our brothers and sisters, to serve our community. So we have common thread that and commonalities, I would say, that should make us work together and leave each other in good relationship. Yeah.
It's Oscar Solis, the new bishop of the Catholic Diocese of Salt Lake City. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're speaking with Utah's new Catholic bishop, Bishop Oscar Solis, talking with him about his faith journey and his plans for leading Utah's 300,000 Catholics. You said when you were installed, and this was in March, that your ministry would be centered on what you called encounter mm-hmm. and dialogue. Mm-hmm. What did you mean? What do you mean, dialogue? What do you mean?
Our mission is to proclaim Jesus Christ, you know, and our role is to see to it that give the people the opportunity to experience and encounter the presence of God in their life. That is what it is. That is what we call encounter, to pave the way for people to experience God's love in their life. And in that process, it is a ministry of accompaniment. We accompany them in their spiritual journey, leading them in order not only to know Christ, but to love Christ and to serve Christ in others. So that's a simple way by which we minister to people. It's a ministry of encounter, you know, a ministry of presence, making ourselves available to people so that we become accessible to them in their need, searching for God, looking for answers in those questions that are important questions in their life, and to accompany them in their spiritual journey so that they grow in their relationship with God and in their good relationship with one another, with other people.
You said dialogue too. You said, but not, here, I'm going to quote you here. You said, but not just any kind of dialogue, but a transformative mm-hmm. one. You mentioned encounter. What do you mean dialogue? What does that mean?
Dialogue is an open communication, hearing each other more than talking to the other, hearing who they are, you know, what they speak about, what they believe, what is in their heart. That is what dialogue is all about, opening yourselves to hear the other, you know. And in knowing each other in the process, it transforms us. It transforms our relationship and our understanding of each other, understanding of who we are, what we believe, to be able to embrace each other in our commonalities on what we agree upon and what we disagree. That is what transformative dialogue is all about. Getting to know each other, our differences and our commonalities, and accepting one another and embracing each other who we are in spite of our differences.
You wrote a pastoral letter at Easter a few months ago. It was called A Springtime for New Evangelization. What did you mean, a springtime for new evangelization? Was this you talked about in the letter? This you said, the spiritual rebirth of our faith and the renewed commitment should be our guiding star. Yeah. What do you mean rebirth, and what do you mean new evangelization? This sounds like you want to take this diocese in some ways in a new direction, almost.
Let me give a little background to that. You know, it was Easter when I issued that pastoral letter.
Yes.
A couple of weeks after that, there is a changing in the season from winter to spring. And I really didn't like winter. And so I said that was my premise when I looked for what do I envision myself doing here in the Diocese of Salt Lake City as a new bishop. Yeah. What can I offer? What kind of vision can I offer the people? Ever since I came here, as early as January during that first press conference, people were asking me already, what is my plan? What is your agenda? How are you going to lead us? How are you going to be our bishop? So I said, I'm new. You are new to me as well, and I am new to you. You know. So I said, let's find something in common. You know, my role is to see to it that the mission of the church is carried out in the local church of the Diocese of Salt Lake City, to evangelize. To evangelize means just to preach the gospel, to preach about Jesus Christ, that they may come to know him, to love him, and to serve him. And so I was thinking about springtime. What a beautiful vision to have a rebirth and renewal in our faith life, in our communities, you know, in order to see that the church is alive. That is my goal. That is what rebirth means, that there was some newness in the faith life of the community, and that the preaching of the gospel will be described in its newness, new in its ardor, new in its expression, you know, and you in its method, according to the thinking and leaning of Pope John Paul II and other popes after him.
Pope Francis has said to Catholic bishops that you should get out among your flocks, not hide behind rituals. He said, you must be shepherds who smell like your sheep.
I love Pope Francis. He's a true pastor. A pastor does not stay in the house. You know, a shepherd does not stay in the house. He goes along with the sheep wherever they are, leading them to pasture and leading back home to safety and refuge. That is the role of a shepherd. And that's why I take it to heart seriously, that I am not in my office, I'm not in my home, but I have a special ministry, a very simple, basic ministry to the people entrusted to my pastoral care. It is the ministry of presence. You know, that I am their word. I bring the church to the people. I don't bring the people to church. Hopefully that bringing the church to them, they become church itself. That is what it means of being a shepherd to the flock entrusted to me here in the Diocese of Salt Lake City.
What do you think Pope Francis has meant for Catholicism? What did he bring? How do you identify the spirit that he brought? I have a few questions that get some kind of particular things, but what has Pope Francis, do you think, done for the image of Catholicism or Catholicism in general?
I think that, I don't know, I'm not a theologian, and I'm not really a theologian, but my position in that, my take on that is that Pope Francis tried to divert the minds and heart of the people on how they look on the church. It is not just a building or an institution. It is people, it is community. You know, and it is about the members, the living stones. It's not the stone that made the church, but it's the people that made the church. So that made it different. It made it in a very more personal way of becoming a church, of who you are when you become a part of the Catholic faith, of the church. You know.
It's interesting. I think there's some sense that the church may have been headed in, maybe it was too rigid, let's put it this way, and that Pope Francis opened up some of these bigger ideas. One of the things that one writer put it early in Pope Francis's installment was that it seemed as though he was declaring a kind of truce in the culture wars. Have you thought about that?
Somehow I read it. I don't exactly know the context by which it was mentioned. But we focus on culture war. But culture is just plain word. Culture is who we are. It is culture that makes us. And that's who we are, our identity. So I don't think there's a war against each other. But it is just the confusion of our identity as persons, as people, as society, as a global community. I don't want to have wars anymore. I don't think we don't need wars. I think that they're just differentiations of the way we think and look at things and our perspective of what's going on. You know? So war might be too...
Too strong a word?
Too tough. Well, too strong a word.
Right. Well, but the point of this writer was that he was calling a truce, and the Pope's approach to the church has been described as kind of being... a field hospital after a battle. Mm-hmm. Here's what the Pope said, yes. And I really like this. I wanted to get you to comment on this. He said, the thing the church needs most today is the ability to heal wounds and to warm the hearts of the faithful. Mm-hmm. It is useless to ask a seriously injured person if he has high cholesterol and about the level of his blood sugars. He says, you have to heal wounds.
Yes, yes.
And then we can talk about everything else after that. We have to heal the wounds. Mm-hmm. Are you with that? Do you agree with that?
Definitely.
Because the question comes up. I mean, he said this in the context of a question of where the church stands on the question of somebody who is gay, for example. Mm-hmm. And he said, as you know, famously, who am I to judge? And then he went ahead and talked about this, that, you know, we don't need to worry about all of these things right now, except for attending to people's wounds.
Right.
Would you talk about that?
The context of the Pope, I believe, is consistent to what the Church has been teaching all along. It is our love and respect for the dignity of every person. It is not about condemning. It is not about highlighting what differ, but how people differ from one another. But it's the acceptance of who they are and embracing them with love, compassion, and understanding. So much so that the Church should be that way. It should be a place where people feel they are loved, they are accepted, they are embraced, you know, and they receive, and they could feel the mercy and love of God in our own relationship with them, in our own dispositions and how we look at them and treat them. And so that is the personal touch of our Holy Father on those issues. The fundamental thing I would say is that treat others, what Pope Francis was trying to advocate and teach us is that treat others with love, with compassion, with mercy, and with understanding.
Yeah. There's an article that appeared in a Vatican-approved publication recently, and mm-hmm. it accused, as you, I'm sure you're aware of this, I'm not sure how much you want to talk about it, but it accused conservative Catholic leaders in this country, in America, mm-hmm. of getting too involved in politics, injecting religion into politics. And the article suggested that in some ways there are some conservative Catholic leaders in this country who are out of step with the mainstream under the leadership of Pope Francis, that more broad, tolerant perspective. Do you think that's true? Do you worry? Not, you don't have to be critical of your fellow leaders, but do you see that, and have you ever worried about that?
I think we should be open to this kind of discussions, that we are able to talk about it, to talk about issues and present your views about it, and to find out what works best. And so we're open to dissent, we're open to differences, and open to dialogue to be able to talk about it, so that people will understand where we're coming from and what we believe and how we approach that kind of belief. I think that's very important, that we have a good civil discussion and engagement about issues that affect us and our relationship with one another.
But do you worry, though, Bishop, that the Church in this country, according mm-hmm. to this mm-hmm. article, has gotten too involved in political issues, that you should stay out of those if you can?
I don't know how they say that. I don't know where they're coming from, but when you talk about politics, we are talking about the morality of politics, not about politics in itself.
True. It's
true. It was the morality, the good and bad, and the bad, or the right and wrongness of issues and or laws that have been legislated that affect the lives of our community.
And this is very much your role, you say.
That's what it is. Yeah. It's not about politics, about the morality of those legislations of laws that were crafted by our elected officials. Mm-hmm. Are they for the common good? Are they uplifting or upholding and safeguarding the dignity of the human person? Are the laws that are promulgated provide the basic necessities of people? Those are the things that we have to question. It's not politics. That's the morality of the law, how it affects the life of the people.
On the occasion of you being installed, you said this. You said the right of religious freedom is under attack. Mm-hmm. And you said, and I'll quote you here, we are ridiculed for taking a stand on the sanctity of life. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you about that because it does seem to get to that moral question behind some of these political things. You say this. You said human dignity, mm-hmm. it's a term you just used a moment ago, should encompass the immigrant, the refugee, the resident. And that's so far so good, mm-hmm. right? But you also say that human dignity begins in the mother's womb. And so yes. It sounds like you're thinking there's a contradiction here. We talk in maybe mm-hmm. secular society or a society about the dignity of the immigrant. Mm-hmm. We talk about the dignity of the refugee. Mm-hmm. But the dignity you say exists in the mother's womb may not yeah. be something we focus on.
The fundamental doctrine of the Church is that life is absolute. And our belief is that life begins at the moment of conception. And so the doctrine of the Church states that life that there is something, that there is dignity and holiness in life, because it's something that comes from God. It is not ours. It comes from God. And that is why, as God is holy, life is holy, because anything that comes from God is good and holy. And so the fundamental teaching of the church is that life shall be protected, safeguarded, and nourished from the moment of conception until natural death. And so anything that impinges or runs contrary to upholding the dignity and sanctity of life is something wrong. It's natural and immoral. And that's where the context I'm coming from.
Right.
You know? And that is why anything like the law, I mean, allowing abortion, we do not agree with that because it runs counter to our belief.
Right.
And that is why we differentiate from that. We are not entering politics. We are touching about the morality of the law allowing abortion, you know, allowing physician-assisted suicide,
yeah.
You know. When our role as a church, as Christians, as people who believe in the goodness of God, should uphold, nourish, safeguard, and protect life in all phases, you know, that's why we speak anything that runs contrary to that kind of belief. So that if people are deprived of the basic needs or basic services, then we ask the government, we ask our politicians, you know, to please provide the basic needs of our housing, employment, health, insurance, and everything. That's where we stand for. The dignity of every human person, whether you're still in the womb, you're already a child, you're a growing person until you're old and terminally ill.
Yeah.
You're still a person worth defending, safeguarding, and nourishing until death.
I wonder, Bishop, how you're dealing with the question of same-sex marriage, how you're thinking about it as the question comes to you from your parishioners. You've written that Christ instituted marriage as a sacred institution, making the family the sanctuary of life. You write, confused values and various moral ills adversely harm our families these days. We need to teach and uphold the fundamental truth of marriage as a loving union between a man and a woman. The LDS Church has had to deal with this. It's been controversial, of course, a policy that they enacted a few years ago, extremely polarizing. How do you deal with that question among your parishioners?
As a Catholic Church, I teach the doctrine of our church, what we believe. And we believe that marriage is a sacred union between a man and a woman. And marriage is it's not only unitive, but procreative. That means a marriage between man and woman. And its purpose is not only the union between a man and woman as husband and wife, but the mission that is procreative. And so that is the basic understanding and teaching of the Catholic Church.
Right.
You know, and that it runs counter to what people nowadays, other people, adhere to about same-sex union and all those kind of stuff, you know. And so it just so happened that this is what we believe and that's what we teach, what is right.
So if a parishioner comes to you, he's he's gay, he's in love with another man, wants to be married, knows he can't have your blessing, I mean, officially, of course, but what do you say to him?
It's quite challenging to be answering that in a real situation because I have my own relatives and cousins who have been in that situation. You know, and I wish them well, you know, and I hope that it works out, but I don't agree with it, you know. You know very well that it is not what I believe. I believe that the union in the sacrament of marriage is between a man and a woman. So may God bless you, you know. I do not agree with what you're doing, you know, and I respect you for what you have chosen.
There was a, I read an article about you which said that one of your favorite quotes comes from the book The Little Prince. And it's when the fox is talking to the little prince and he says, "One sees clearly only with the heart. The essential is invisible to the eye." What is it about that line that is affecting you?
I really don't recall anymore.
Oh, is that right?
when you turn 60 and everything.
Yeah. Because I wondered about that. I thought, it was described as your favorite quote.
It's my favorite quote. You know, that little book, Little Princess. So many beautiful saying there.
That's true.
And I said, you just don't judge any person by what they are from the outside. What is important is what's in their heart. And that's why whenever you see, when you mention about the gay, the lesbian, you know, I don't see them as who they are, as gay and lesbian. I see them as a person. I see them as a brother, as a sister. I see them as God's creation, you know. And who knows what's in their heart? Only God knows what's in your heart. You know, eyes are very deceptive. You know that very well. You know, that's what they say. I learned it from school at the early age. Don't judge a book by its cover.
Yeah.
You know, so it runs that way. I want to see to it that there is something more beyond what eyes can see. You know, and usually the heart sees better than the eyes. And it works better in society, in our relationship with God, you know, with one another, when we use our heart instead of our eyes and our minds, you know.
Oscar Solis, the new bishop of the Catholic Diocese of Salt Lake City. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with Utah's new Catholic bishop, Bishop Oscar Solis. I'm wondering, when you became installed and you started to look, trying to make an assessment of what do we need and what's the condition of the parish, so as you're making this assessment, there's a term used in Mormonism, which I'm familiar with, whether people are quote-unquote active. You know, whether they go to church, whether they show up on Sunday. Are Utah Catholics active? How many aren't, quote-unquote, active? How do you see it?
Well, there's a survey that was conducted a couple of years ago, and the result was that between 25 to 30% of church members go to church. You know, so in other words, very small percentage of those who consider themselves members of the church,
yes,
attend regularly. We have no way of figuring it out how many of them really practice it in the real sense of living it, you know. But the gauge somehow is how many people really come to church and participate in the activities of the church, primarily worship, you know, and other activities, church activities. So I would say that it's in a low percentage. And that's why we need to double our effort.
You worry about this then?
Oh, yes, definitely. I worry about that, you know. I wish at least half of the people who believe...
showed up. Yeah, right?
But do you think, live their faith. You know how you will see the difference? If we have a better society, if we have a better community, you know, a community, a society, and a family that embraces God, that translate into the relationship with one another, where they treat each other with respect, with dignity, with compassion, and with love. It sounds like utopic, but that is the measure by which you gauge that we're doing our job.
Yeah.
So our job or ministry is never ending. There is no such thing as vacation in our ministry or vocation. You know, we are always on the go like Energizer battery. You know, and thank God, maybe that's the reason why our tradition do not allow married priests, because we have to have our life dedicated to our parishioners. I think there's value in it, you know.
But why aren't they coming? 1.2 billion Catholics in the world. It's growing in the developing world. But as you know, it's in decline in Europe. It's in decline in the United States. Why, do you think?
I am really not sure exactly how to answer that, but based on the history, As society progresses and become industrialized and materialized, God becomes more distant. Think about the industrial age, the industrial revolution in Europe. You know, as soon as Europe was a very religious country, and as soon as they become industrialized, modernized, you know, it becomes so materialistic that it seems that God becomes distant from them. You know, and it came to a point that they assumed that everything can be accomplished through our human efforts. Achievements, endeavors, progress, and development seems to be attributed to human intelligence. So who needs God if you can accomplish all these things? Only to realize later on that I don't think it's the answer for everything. We could not find answer for everything. It goes back to the questioning. You know, there must be something more beyond this world. You know, there must be something more deeper or something deeper to find meaning in life, in our existence. And so people start to wonder. People are no longer satisfied with fame, knowing that when they grow old, when they have those creases on their faces, you know, they go back to reality. You know, fame is gone. Honor is gone. Power is gone. Money is gone. Anytime you can lose it. Where do you hold on to that will last forever? And that's where faith comes in. That's where religion comes in. There comes in God. Only God can provide you those things, the absolute. Everything is fleeting and passing in this world. Nothing is permanent other than change.
Right.
You know? Or taxes.
You know? In your pastoral letter in April, you wrote, "It is necessary for every Catholic to learn more about the essential teachings of Christ and our church in order to gain a deeper understanding." Is that important to you? And do Utah Catholics or Catholics in general, do they know what it means to be Catholic in that sense? Is that one of the things you're...
Yes. That is my vision. My vision is for every Catholic member of the church to know what they believe. You know, it's so hard to actualize and to live something that you do not know. So it's very essential to know who God is in your life, who Jesus is in your life, to be able to embrace Him. So it's very fundamental to know your faith, to be able to live your faith. You know, and our living the faith is not intended only for our own. Faith is to be shared with others. Something that is good, something that you're excited about, that you cannot help contain it to yourself. But look, I got something beautiful. That is what faith should be about. You're excited about it. You're enthusiastic about it. And you cannot wait until everybody knows about it and have a part of it. That is what religion should be. That is what faith life should be. You know, it gives you joy so that it is radiated in your heart. In your face, that everybody would see immediately that, man, you look so happy. Are you on drugs? That is the best compliment that you could hear. You know, when people are happy and said, "Oh, Bishop, you're so happy all the time. You seem, are you on drugs?" "No, I'm on high with Jesus." You know, that should be what's in your heart, that you find peace, joy, that you cannot cover it. Everybody would notice it in the twinkling of your eyes, you know, on how your face looks, that you would see that. Man, I want to find out what is that that makes you happy and at peace. And so I will share to them what I have. Have you known God in your life? Have you discovered Jesus? And the difference what it makes when you have Him with you. You know, so try to make them become interested about it. So that provides them the hunger and thirst to learn more. So that knowing and discovering who God is, you could share the joy that you have with them.
What do you worry about for your diocese? What do you worry about?
Well, personally, I worry also. I'm a person like anybody else. You know, sometimes I worry about what I'm going to eat tomorrow. I'm worried about my health, you know. I worry about my hair every now and then. No, I'm just kidding. I mean, there are things that we normally worry about, but those are peripheral things that really don't matter, you know. I worry about myself, what I will be in the future. I worry about myself when I die, thinking that I hope that I will be in heaven, you know, with God, in union with God. But what more remorse is actually is that I worry about my responsibility. I take seriously my role as a shepherd, as a priest, to the people entrusted to my care. That's what I worry about. Am I doing my ministry as it should be carried out? And am I responsible enough? Am I a father to the family, to my children, to God's children? Am I a good shepherd? Those are the things that I worry. I worry about my own spiritual health. Am I praying a lot? Am I really God in me? Those are the things that I really worry about. It's not about my looks, not about, you know. Sometimes vanity comes in every now and then. You want to have a nice cloth, you know. And you look at the mirror and see your receding hairline and all those things. But you, after that, you overcome it, you know. But these are the essential things that I worry. Am I doing my ministry? Have I put God as my priority in my life? Do I pray more than I should be? Do I witness what it means to be a Christian, a father, and a shepherd to the people? Those are the crucial things that I worry more about other than other things. I'm so blessed I have everything, actually. God is so good, you know. I'm so blessed even to be here in Utah. You know, it's a blessing. It's a tremendous blessing that I must say, Lord, you're so good, man. And that's what my brother Mormons would say. He's getting better. And I love it.
It's Oscar Solis, the new bishop of the Catholic Diocese of Salt Lake City. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.